Hello everyone and welcome to Investing by the Books, a podcast by Redeye. I'm your host, Eddie Palmgren, and with me here in the studio is my friend and colleague, Niklas Sävås. How are you?
I'm great and really happy to introduce today's interview. And we are now also very close to Redeye's annual Serial Acquirers Conference on March 6th in Stockholm.
Yes, we've been organizing this conference over the past months and it really feels like a birthday coming up. So I know many of you listeners will join us in Stockholm and I'm really looking forward to see you. And for today's episode of Investing by the Books, we have the pleasure of sharing an exclusive conversation where Christian Billinger talks to Edward Chancellor about his book, Capital Returns. So Niklas, for new listeners, who is Christian and why has he taken our place this time?
Christian Billinger is a London-based investor heading his family office, Billinger Förvaltning. And since a number of years, Christian is a contributor to the Investing by the Books website and also this podcast. In episode 8, he interviewed Lawrence Cunningham about his book, Quality Investing. And in episode 32, we had the great pleasure of discussing Terry Smith's book, Investing for Growth, with Christian. So Eddie, who is Edward Chancellor?
Chancellor is a financial historian, a journalist, and investment strategist. He is currently a columnist for Reuters Breaking Views and an occasional contributor to, for example, Wall Street Journal and Financial Times. Edward Chancellor is also a prominent author, with titles including Devil Take the Hindmost, Capital Account, and The Price of Time. And for this episode, the focus will be on his book Capital Returns. So what is this one about?
Capital Returns is a book that details Marathon Asset Management's equity investing strategy. And specifically, it also covers the years after the IT crisis in 2000. And Marathon was founded in 1986 and is a privately owned investment management firm based in London, which has produced several iconic investors such as Nick Sleep and Jeremy Hosking. A highlight for me with the book is Marathon's deep focus on the supply side dynamics of businesses where large capital investments in a sector typically leads to lower returns ahead.
Capital Returns was published in 2015 by Palgrave Macmillan, and we are honored to have its author on the show today. Here comes Christian Billinger's conversation with Edward Chancellor.
Just in a few brief sort of sentences, how did the whole project come about? You know, what was your relationship to the guys at Marathon? Why did you sort of decide to pursue this at the time? I know you'd been involved in the Capital Accounts book, right? But how did the whole thing come about?
Capital Account was the first book I edited on the capital cycle. And that, how did that come about? That came about because Marathon had been taking a big bet against the tech bubble back in 1999, 2000. The biggest risk you were taking, was from an investment perspective, was whether to be to be underweight T-Mobile or Nokia or any of these other TMT companies. So Marathon had. And I'd just written this book on history of financial speculation called Devil Take the Hindmost. So in sort of 1999, 2000, all the bearish investors were quite keen on Devil Take the Hindmost because it gave a sort of historical support for their position. But what was interesting about the Marathon approach is that, as you know, it's entirely focused on the supply side. And one of the things I noted about speculative manias is in most cases, not always, but in most cases, they engender a massive increase in supply. And it's that increase in supply from a surge of investment that actually plays a major role in the poor returns that the investments produce. One example is the British railway mania of the 1840s, which is a nice case because railways at the time were a new technology and the early railways were highly profitable. And then there was a railway mania and a surge of investment in railways. And the surge of investment in railways was such that roughly the the amount of new investment was estimated at roughly equivalent to English, British GDP at the time. And or another way of looking at it is the new railways proposed were equivalent to the entire existing toll pike systems, the systems of roads in the country. And as the upshot of that, the investment was, you know, indiscriminate. And so we had, I like to cite the case of three different railway lines running between London and Peterborough. So massive overinvestment. And that massive overinvestment meant that once mania had got, you know, passed, the railway system was locked into permanently lower returns. Now, if you then fast forward to the 1990s, we then got, you know, a surge of investment. Well, particularly in telecoms. I mean, leaving aside, you know, obviously you've got a lot of investment in relatively small miscellaneous dot-coms. But the real investment was in laying out the telecoms infrastructure for the internet. And what was interesting about that case was that there was one predominant forecast for growth of internet traffic. The internet traffic was said to be doubling every 2 months. And in fact, actually, it turns out, and we knew this at the time, because some academic at the University of Minnesota had actually crunched the numbers, that actually the data traffic was only doubling every 4 months. So a huge discrepancy in the forecast and massive investment, you see. And it set this combination of an inaccurate demand forecast with a surge in supply that brings about the low returns. Anyhow, so that was how the capital account book, you know, really was looking through the sort of wreckage of the TMT bubble from an investment perspective, and actually I got the job because I'd been at Lazard's a few years earlier with a colleague who then went to work, called Charles Carter, who then went to work for Marathon. So it was Charles who brought me into the project.
So one of the things that sort of strikes me about the idea of capital cycle investing is that I think the first time I read the book, or certainly when I first heard of the concept, I think I assumed, like many people, that it's all about investing countercyclically or identifying, you know, flows of capital into and out of industries. But that seems to be one important part of it. But it seems like there's a second important part, which I think became more important over time to Marathon, which is to invest in companies that altogether avoid the impact of that capital cycle. Is that a fair reading of the book?
People sometimes say, oh, well, does this capital cycle theory only apply to, you know, capital intensive industries like mining and so on? And it's true. It works for mining, it works for energy extraction, it works for semiconductors. But I think really, as a discipline, you can use it for just about every investment, because either you are in the capital cycle and going through the vicissitudes of the capital cycle, sort of overinvestment and underinvestment, in which case you need to time your entrance and exit from an investment, or you're in a business that is exempt from the capital cycle. I mean, the classic case would be a so-called quality company, quasi-monopolistic business. But then I think Marathon sort of took it into the area of what you might call quality cyclicals or quality industrials. And in particular into, as you know, in the sort of global supply chains, you have relatively small companies that have niches within a global supply chain. So, and that niche makes them relatively secure. Doesn't mean that they won't, you know, suffer a loss of, you know, a sort of a contraction when, you know, the economy turns down. But on the whole, they're much safer from this sort of surge in overinvestment. So you should always think of the capital cycle when making any investment, really, even if it's only to say, actually, the capital cycle doesn't really apply in this instance.
Yeah. So one of the interesting things I find about what you said there is that most investors seem to, although I also think these labels are misleading, value and growth or value and quality, but most investors, I think, you know, define themselves and other people define them quite clearly as either traditional value or as quality or as growth. Or, but it seems that this approach would enable you, and actually in the case of Marathon, they were able to implement both, if right, as in, so in the case of companies where the capital cycle does apply, that would be more similar to a traditional or deep value investor, right? Where it doesn't apply, you'd probably typically define that more as a quality or a growth investor. Is it fair to say that it couldn't cover that whole spectrum of styles or philosophies?
Well, if you think of a value and a growth, you know, the value strategy and the growth strategy, value is, you know, crudely defined as, you know, businesses that's selling below its book value. Now, if you're in an industry where the businesses are selling below their book, there is, on the whole, not 100%, but in the whole, there's a disincentive to invest. Yeah, and then take growth, trading above your book, there is an incentive to invest. So, in fact, growth and value are have an underlying capital cycle impetus to them. And I don't think this has really been teased out when the growth and value were sort of identified value was identified as something that was expected to outperform and growth to underperform in the long distant days. I think, you know, if you think of it now, a new factor has been added to, or two new factors really, from French and Farmer, you know, who developed these models of different factors leading to superior returns. One is straightforwardly investment, and that was sort of interesting because they came out with that in 2015, so good 10 years after Capital Accounts been published. And quality. And quality, as I go back to what I was saying earlier, is that if you're in a monopolistic position, you're not going to have to invest along with your competitors. So you're going to, everything else being equal, you'll have a more disciplined approach to investment because you're in a stronger competitive position.
So that seems to be one reason why quality is a better, you know, to the extent we want to use labels at all, but label for those companies that sort of almost sit outside the capital cycle as opposed to growth. Because, of course, as you say in the book, growth, if anything, certainly when it comes to asset growth, is, if anything, a sort of contraindicator, right? That often causes the issues that you could experience with this cycle.
So quality is interesting in that it has delivered positive alpha, I think, since time immemorial. And this is, I'm citing my old boss at GMO, Jeremy Grantham, who developed quality strategy at GMO. He says quality can be expected to add 100 basis points a year of outperformance relative to the market, even though, by definition, quality is less risky than the market. So it has a lower beta than the market, but it has a higher return. I think probably underlying it are these, you know, what Warren Buffett called moats. And those moats are, as I say, protecting you from the vicissitudes of overinvestment. But then to go back to growth, you can have a business that is, so to speak, a growth stock, you know, trading, you know, above book, growing fast, And then the question is it caught up in a negative capital cycle, or is it a benign one? And if it's a benign one, you can expect the high returns to persist for longer. And likewise, frankly, you can be a value stock and continue to overinvest and therefore expect lower returns. And so one has to sort of analyze these matters on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah. And the progression that seems to have occurred at Marathon in terms of moving increasingly towards the type of companies that sort of almost sit outside the whole framework of the cap, or where the capital cycle certainly doesn't apply in terms of the depressing returns. Do you think that was that a function of the environment, or do you think that was an evolution of their thinking? Did their approach evolve, or was it simply a case of, you know, the sort of structural decline in bond rates, et cetera, just made for a much more, you know, that made the quality sort of part of the market much more attractive?
I would say, well, go back to, you know, the value growth dichotomy. I think value, you know, Marathon and most investors would have seen themselves as value shops. But then, as I say, once you put the sort of capital cycle goggles on, you can buy both growth and value and quality. And I don't know exactly what led to a shift in their style or portfolio composition, if you want to call it that, because they would say their style remains consistent. But it was very fortunate because, as you know, sort of roughly at the turn of the century, the crude measures of value that had seemed very reliable for previous decades ceased to function. So it was a nice, fortuitous shift. And again, as I say, what's good about the capital cycle is it allows the investor to, it really increases the number of stocks that an investor will consider for a purchase. It does seem, if you're a value shop, right, and you can only buy value stocks, you're necessarily limiting the amount of potential investments. And as you're probably aware, given that roughly 50% of value stocks actually turn out to be value traps and lose money, you're limiting your investments and increasing your chance of making mistakes. So that doesn't seem particularly wise.
Yeah, agreed. Does this, Edward, framework apply as well to the overall market as it does to individual industries and companies? I'm asking because some of the case studies, as I call them in chapters 4 to 7, so I think you discussed some indicators that could suggest there's a bubble forming in the market, or rather the authors of the articles discuss things such as speculative behavior, you know, very high levels of IPOs, private equity transactions, etc. So do you think it's as reliable when it comes to looking at the overall market, or is it more useful as a framework for security selection, so to speak?
I think it's an important and interesting fact to consider when you're looking at the overall market. I mean, two things. If you have a market that declines from a sort of high level, it might be driven by valuation. You know, the valuation can be sufficient to bring down a market, but it's valuation with excess supply that seems to be key. And take, for instance, real estate markets around the world. Go back to the global financial crisis and run up to that. In the countries that had real estate bubbles and massive increase in supply, namely United States, Ireland, and Spain, those countries suffered very severe, real estate busts. And in countries where new supply was limited, a residential building was limited, such as Britain and Australia, they largely avoided the bust. Now, you know, I was interested 13 years ago, sort of immediate aftermath of the financial crisis in what was going on in China. The Chinese were investing over 50% of GDP, and the stock market wasn't particularly valued. It wasn't particularly expensive on a sort of PE basis. It was trading at sort of 10 times earnings, something like that. But if you go and look at the returns of Chinese equities over the last 13, 14 years, they're flat. And I think that the low returns from China over that period are a function of massive misallocation of capital. Then if you, and actually go back a bit earlier to the 1990s, capital cycle was actually developed by a former, one of the founders of Marathon, Jeremy Hosking, when he was he covered among other things sort of Asian markets for Marathon, and so in the first half of the 1990s he observed massive increase in investment in Thailand, and where you had real estate bubble and massive in surge of investment. And if you look at the ratio of well, first of all, you can see the investment share of GDP in Thailand and the other so-called tiger economies. You can see that lower than China in the last decade, but sort of roughly in the range of 40% of GDP. But actually, I actually got the numbers for the capex to depreciation ratio of the Thai stock market in that period. You see a very high capex to depreciation ratio in the mid-1990s. And it's really only when the capex collapses after the Asian crisis that the market is put on a firm basis for a very good recovery. I really see if I'm thinking about a market that is going to be in a robust state position to take off after being depressed, you want it to be cheap, obviously. You want it to be in a benign capital cycle. In other words, you want them to slash capital spending, which everything else being equal will lead to higher profit margins going forward. And you probably want to be in a sort of benign phase in the credit cycle. And if you have all those stars aligned, then things will probably go well. But I certainly feel that valuation alone is not the answer. Take for instance the US stock market in the last decade. So by sort of, the markets recovered after the GFC pretty quickly. And I was working at GMO, we used sort of mean reverting valuation models for the entire market, and the US market looked expensive on a valuation basis. However, for a variety of reasons, American companies weren't investing very much, as you're probably aware. So you could say high valuation and a depressed capital cycle, that meant that the US carried on producing superb investment returns over the last decade, whereas go to China, low valuations and high investment and miserable returns. You mentioned the TMT bubble in the late 1990s. You can see, you see the valuation market going up on a sort of, you can look at it on a sort of Tobin's Q basis, replacement cost basis. And then I don't know if I have it in the book, but I do chart, investment to GDP against the Tobin's Q, and you can see it coming up. So, these things don't always hold. You can have a highly valued market that doesn't elicit a lot of investment, and then you can have one that does. So again, you just have to see what's going on.
Yeah, they're two very interesting case studies, the ones you mentioned, the US and China. Would Marathon use the framework?
I don't think. I think they use it on the stock. I have asked them whether they use it for sort of allocating between markets, and I don't think they do. Which is their choice.
No, of course, but and not in terms of balance sheet management either. In your impression, as in, you know, increasing or decreasing cash levels or employing leverage, or do you know whether they would typically use the framework for that or not really?
When you say increasing leverage, what do you mean by that?
Well, either taking on leverage or increasing cash levels in the portfolio, as in keeping some liquidity dry.
Yeah, I don't think they would. Well, they wouldn't use leverage. I would have thought their mandates are to be fully invested. So,
but do you think it could be used for that? Say for, you know, a private investor who wants to adopt a framework. Do you think it can sort of helpfully be used for managing cash levels, etc.?
It slightly depends, because, you know, assuming that you're an international investor, you're likely to find it's very rare that you're going to find the whole world caught up in a sort of investment frenzy. I mean, it's not, you know, in the late 90s, that pretty much was the case.
Do you think it works as well, the framework, when it comes to capital light industry? So if you look at software, for instance, where it's more difficult at least to use the same kind of metrics that you would for, say, traditional industry, right? In terms of CapEx to depreciation and some of the other, or, you know, you could look at loan growth for a bank. But for some of these, say, software and other digitally enabled companies, do you think the framework, it may work as well in principle, but how can you apply it as easily to those types of businesses?
I mean, the problem with tech companies is they tend to expense their investment. And as you're probably aware, you know, some, you know, analysts will actually adjust that so you can see what their actual investment has been. But, you know, look where we are at the moment. You've got, you know, frenzy of investment in AI at the moment. And, you know, that AI investment undergoing at the moment is sort of roughly on par in aggregate with the mining capex boom of early 2010s. So that's quite a lot of capex. And, you know, frankly, everything else being equal, we would expect that to deliver some hefty disappointments at some stage in the future. So yeah, you have to play with the numbers. But you know, you can do it. I mean, all the value guys now make an adjustment for software by turning their expenses, you know, into investment.
I did want to ask you about what you just touched upon, because the book, I think, extends, the articles in there extend to 2015, right? So I wanted to ask you about whether you have any examples developing since then of clear, obvious sort of excesses in the market, you know, given, so we're recording this in December 23, but you mentioned AI potentially. If you look at other things like, you know, China, I guess, has been a more sort of long running story, but if you look at, you know, electric vehicles or any other examples, are there any obvious places to be looking, do you think, at the moment where there seems to be hysteria and too much capital going in?
Well, I mean, I think the EV is a, you know, a good case. And I, you know, when I talk on the capital cycle in recent years, I have been underlining the EV investment surge, and you know, as you saw, that was also accompanied by, you know, surge of new paper. So there's a lot of those SPACs, you know, launched in 2020 were EV related, and yeah, I think that'll doom the car makers, really. I wouldn't touch them.
Are there any other ones, Edward? Any other obvious case studies at the moment?
You know, what I find quite interesting is the inverse of, you know, obviously what one's looking out for from an investment perspective, not overinvestment, but underinvestment. And it strikes me there'd be massive underinvestment in energy. And you know, if you remember back in 2020, market cap of Tesla exceeded all entire US energy industry, you know, the Exxons and the Chevrons of this world. And the very depressed investment in oil, you know, there was all this talk of oil investments being stranded assets. And again, this is, you know, absolutely classic capital cycle error, where you're looking at a sort of long-term projection forecast. You're ignoring the fact that actually demand for oil just trudges up, you know, goes up every year, regardless of how many COP conferences they hold, and they cut investment. And I heard, for instance, I was at a conference last year, and a guy presented what I thought was a classic capital cycle case, where the entire offshore US drilling industry went bust in 2020, and the person who was presenting this idea, he was touting a stock called Noble. It has these ships that, you know, have very precision ships for drilling in deep water. Those ships were made in Singapore and in Scandinavia. And this guy went to the shipbuilders, and the shipbuilder said, "We're not making this anymore. We're not making these boats anymore." So you've got demand for oil going up, and a very severe capital constraint, at least in the deep sea oil drilling. And, you know, this guy had bought the stock at seven. I think he was touting it last October at 35. Now at roughly 50, it struck me as being a very nice idea that fitted with my view that there was massive underinvestment in energy going forward. And as you see, you know, in the last couple of years, US energy companies have done very nicely. On the positive side, you know, the miners look relatively sort of, you know, they've been, you know, they had their bust in 2014, and they haven't really picked up investment since then. And although I understand, you know, I mean, I haven't been following it very closely, the sort of sub segment of lithium, which has been crashing this year, yeah? And I think that lithium did have a sort of massive surge of investment, so then got locked into a negative capital cycle. But broadly speaking, the miners seem to be in a relatively benign place in the capital cycle. I mean, do you have any other cases that come to mind for you?
Well, one of the follow-ups I wanted to ask you was around the others where we've seen the excess investment going in. So take EVs, or I guess it's always difficult to know until much later. It does feel like many of these sort of excesses haven't been cleared out fully or meaningfully. Is that a fair point? Do you agree with that, or do you disagree? Do you feel that they have largely been sort of cleared?
You have to distinguish between private equity and venture capital. Private equity, on the whole, doesn't lead to an increase in capital investment. It tries to sweat its assets. Whereas there's been this tremendous VC boom, you know, for the last 13 years or so. I did look at the numbers a while back, and in terms of, you know, the amount of money flowing into VC, it was at record levels. These VC funds they're not listed, but they have they do trade. And what I understand is that they are trading at massive discounts to their appraised value. So if you want to buy into a VC fund, you can get it for some, I understand, for about sort of 30% less than its appraised value. Those funds also, they make capital calls in future. So you don't just put the money up, but you commit yourself to providing, you know, more capital in future. And the problem with that, when people are in bubble mode, is that they see a run of, you know, decent returns, and they assume that the money is going to be there. They get a bit overconfident, and then when the time comes that they don't have the money, and then they have to, you know, fire sale assets and so on. So I suspect under the surface things are not very good in that space, and that they probably will get worse in the next year or so, I imagine.
And when it comes to public markets, you know, when you look at the broad indices, of course, things look quite benign or even very constructive, right? But of course, I guess that's largely driven by the fact that you've had this very narrow leadership. So the internals, I guess, as many people are arguing these days, have been much more difficult, right, over the last 12, 24 months or so, as in outside of that very narrow leadership, there's been a lot of pain, right? Do you feel that on the whole? So how should I think about that from a sort of capital cycle framework? Many of these, you know, we had that very long bull run, right? We had that speculative sort of hysteria during the pandemic, and I think coming out of the pandemic. And then it feels like, unlike the piece I just referred to from November 2008, it feels like little of that. There's been certainly at the sort of broad market level, the excesses haven't really been cleared out. Does that make sense? Or do you feel that it's more meaningful to look at the internals and the fact that for many companies and industries, there has been a reckoning?
Well, as you say, in America, the market is kept up by the so-called Magnificent Seven, and rest of market, I understand, is pretty much flat. I mean, it's very rare for, you know, a great bull market to come to an end and then immediately a new sort of tech bubble to form. I've never seen that before. I mean, as you probably know, I've written this book that came out last year on the history of interest called The Price of Time. And there, the you know, the sort of the second part of that book is really to do with the problems that the low interest rates have caused in various parts of the financial system. And I suppose my default position, you know, I may be wrong, but my default position is that coming off these very low interest rates was going to be a remarkably painful experience. And I would have thought that that's my position. It's not really to do with the capital cycle as such. It's more to do with high valuations, misallocation of capital. I mean, you think of all these zombies. These zombie companies are not high investment companies. Some of them might be, but they're just companies that sort of hung on in there when interest rates were very low, and then, you know, and the huge amount of leverage that built up in the system when people were borrowing on very low rates, and that takes a while to work its way through the system. So I would have thought in the next, you know, 2 or 3 years that will continue. I think this year is, in a way, you know, we didn't get a recession. The markets have been very strong. There is, you know, unemployment remains low, and, you know, in the US, the government has a sort of nosebleed fiscal deficit. So and then you've got this AI bubble. So it's a slight time out from the bear market that started last year, but. My guess is that isn't going to hold very much longer.
But of course, some or many seem to argue that, you know, the so-called Magnificent Seven are perhaps the kind of companies that we talked about earlier as quality, as in that they would be able to, you know, that they're not even, that they're largely not subject to the forces of the capital cycle.
Yes, but I just said, I mean, as I was saying earlier, that they are investing vast sums in this AI arms race. And if you think back to earlier technological breakthroughs, the first movers didn't invariably end up winning the game. So I mean, I don't know what's going to happen with AI, but you know, it's conceivable that that has sort of changed the economics of these tech companies. And you know, one of the and as you see at the moment, you know, these companies are being, as they ramp up their AI investment, they're accruing more market cap. Their market cap is boosted by more than their investment, which is a tremendous incentive to carry on investing. So, yeah, we'll see what happens on that front. Yeah.
Do you see any other investors that seem to follow the capital cycle sort of mindset or philosophy? Do you have any examples in public markets today?
I mean, I'm very surprised. I'm relatively surprised by how successful the capital returns book has been, because, as you know, it was quite expensive, and it seems to have sold more than 20,000 copies or whatever. And what I notice is that people use the phrase capital cycle investing, and that, you know, 15, 20 years ago, no one would have used that phrase. They wouldn't have known what you were talking about. So I think it has definitely taken off as an investment concept. I don't know, you know, the danger with investment is that once an idea becomes too popular, it then starts to disappoint. But
do you see any examples of anyone that has actually implemented that kind of thinking? Any, you know, are there any institutions that we may be familiar with, any names that we may be familiar with, where you clearly see that's their framework?
I mean, I know this, you know, I know it was pretty obvious, but I know sort of a mining and natural resources investor in New York called Goering and Rosenzweig. Yeah, I don't know offhand other investors who are adopting it.
Okay, super. So let's just round off then, Edward. I mean, is there anything that you think, obviously, that you wanted to add, or anything you want to say in terms of how people can engage and follow your work?
I've got a website, edwardchancellor.com, where I post my podcast interviews and pieces I've written, so people can look at that. Yeah, with the capital cycle theory, it's gratifying that it's taken off in such a big way. I think the key thing is that investors have to be wary of is not just the capital cycle, but also being driven by, being influenced by projections about demand. Demand projections are highly unreliable and full of wishful thinking. And supply is, at least in the short to medium term, is much more reliable, easier to gauge. And therefore, you know, as an investor, I don't think one should pay any attention to demand. It sounds crazy, but you don't really want to get sucked into these projections of demand growth, and you want to just stay focused on supply. But even if you just ignore the demand side, the demand fantasies, that will put you in a good position. I suppose it's an inherently skeptical, contrarian approach to investment. And as we know, contrarianism by and large succeeds in the investment world.
Great point to end, Edward. Thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to Investing by the Books, a podcast by Redeye. Follow us on Twitter at @IB_Redeye and email us at ib.podcast@redeye.se. To improve, we'd love to hear your feedback, so please rate and review us. Notice that the content in this podcast is not and shall not be construed as investment advice. This information is meant to be informative and for general purposes only. For full disclaimer, visit redeye.se. I'm your host, Eddie Palmian, and until next time, I sincerely wish you the best of luck on your journey through life and investing.